Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me?
Good morning, this is Debbie Burney.
Good morning, this is Dave Kubikin.
And we're two of the attorneys at the Herzog Law Firm. We're going to be here for the next hour to answer your questions on estate planning, estate administration, and Medicaid planning. You can be our very first caller at 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900. And you could be our very first caller on this lovely winter day. How are you doing, Dave?
I'm good, Debbie. How you doing?
Good. Just sitting here in the Saratoga office looking at the rain and sleet. What's it like in Albany?
Well, I'm literally doing the same thing except in the Albany office, and it looks pretty dreary. You know, I don't know if I prefer snow or whatever this is, Debbie, but I think I prefer this. I don't know. What are your thoughts? Are you a snow person?
No, I'm a beach person, so no, I'm done with winter. So, but I think I'd rather have snow than this, because this is just wet. You know what I mean? It's like, if it's going to snow, it just needs to snow.
Yeah, this is a reorganize your closet kind of day, I think.
Could
be. I don't think anyone should be leaving the house, because where are you going to go? And wherever you're going to go, it's going to be inside, and we all know what's going on in the world these days and why maybe you shouldn't be inside with lots of other people, so... maybe a good read a book day or a check out a webinar day. Who knows?
Oh, check out a webinar. Funny that you should mention that. Those of you that listen to us on Saturdays, you know that all of our webinars are actually recorded. They're on our website at www.herzoglaw.com. You can go on there, log on, watch any of the webinars. It's great because you're kind of in control if you have time to watch half of it, or you want to watch all of it and take a break during it, you can. You're in control. You can watch the webinar. But we have live webinars next week, right, Dave?
We do. It's going to be our webinar week. So normally in this COVID era, every Wednesday, we call it Webinar Wednesday, and we do two webinars, one at 10 a.m., one at 2 p.m. And, you know, it ranges from the usual suspects, and sometimes we'll try to switch it up a little bit. And that schedule, as you said, is available on our website. Once a month, we do a webinar week where every single day of that week at 2 p.m., like clockwork, there'll be a live webinar. And we try in that week, Debbie, to touch on everything. And while there is some overlap, because it's hard not to, this coming week, we actually have some fantastic webinars starting with on Monday. So Martin Luther King Day, it's already the 18th of January. We're almost halfway through. We'll be talking about aging in place, which I actually want to get into today with you on the radio if we have an opportunity. Hopefully we do have callers. But we will be talking about aging in place in that webinar at 2 p.m. on Monday. On Tuesday, we're going to be ending all the confusion, because that's what the webinar says we're going to do. We're going to answer all your estate plan questions. It's a Q&A. You can submit questions earlier. We have frequently asked questions we'll be addressing as well. That's Tuesday at 2. Wednesday at 2. A little more general about elder law, not just aging in place, but what are the different moving parts? What are the nursing home options? If someone's in a nursing home, is all lost? No, and you can find out more on Wednesday at 2. Thursday, the 21st at 2, it's estate planning in prime time, an overview of kind of a little bit of everything, taking a spin off of some TV shows we all grew up with, perhaps, that makes things a little easier to understand. And then on Friday, Debbie, my personal favorite, I think the more popular webinar is wills versus trusts, the differences and similarities of a last will and testament and the different kinds of trusts, what is best for what do you need, et cetera, et cetera. And they're all really great opportunities. No pressure, just to get some information and maybe lead you to further discussions with us or anyone else.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great opportunity. Hopefully you're available at 2 in the afternoon to watch them live. And we also take questions. I do have a lot of people that will ask questions in the chat, you know, during the Zoom. And it's great because it almost is kind of like when we used to do them live, we'd have people that ask questions, and then that would trigger another question by another person, because most people have the exact same questions. It's funny. It's just they don't realize it till someone mentions it.
Well, you know, that's a very good point. And that's kind of how, you know, it works on the radio as well. We might go 25 minutes without a peep from the callers, and then someone calls because they heard about something called a life estate deed. And then when you know, we get three or four calls on the same topic because people, you know, I think they listen to learn, but also they're learning from other callers who might be going through similar things.
Yeah, it's interesting the changes that the economy and everything is going through, and there's a lot of people that are kind of falling through the cracks because they need care at home and they don't know how to get it and they can't afford to pay for it. And one of the things that we present on Aging in Place is what is available, not just community Medicaid, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, but there's other services that are available to seniors that you may not even know that you qualify for.
Yeah, like things beyond Medicaid, right? You're talking about services that are maybe available in your county that aren't available in others, veteran programs. There's so many different ways to solve, you know, the puzzle. And I think we're real lucky, Debbie, in what we do, because every day is different. Every fact pattern is different. And I get the greatest pleasure out of trying to solve the problem. The problem is someone is getting older and they're a fall risk, but we don't have the right caretakers. Or the problem is going to be that, we just lost a loved one and we're trying to figure out the next steps. And whatever that issue may be, obviously I think we're real well suited to handle it. And the webinars, the seminars, this radio program, and in general, our consultations, they're free, right? And you can get your ducks in a row. You can get some information. You know, Debbie's been doing this her whole career. I've been doing this my whole career. Harry, Jane Marie. And this is what we do, right? We do real estate law. But when I say we do it, Debbie and I don't do it. Dan Glasser does it. In this, specific area of law, Debbie, one that you can't avoid because guess what? We're getting older as we talk right now. And one day we're not going to be here. You're going to have to face it eventually. And as people will find out, the default plans that exist out there, if you don't plan, if you put your head in the sand, they're not very good. And we can make it better. So, makes me feel good about what we do for a living.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I've had several people come in this week or call this week that were people that said, well, my sister told me to call you because you did their estate planning, or I did their estate planning for their parents, and everything was so seamless. We had a gentleman come in this week that his father had passed away. His mother had passed away 4 years ago. His father passed away, and we were going through the documents, and he's like, well, what do I need to do? And we're like, well, you need to just cash everything in and distribute it. What? That's all I need to do? Mm-hmm. That's all you need to do. Just cash everything in and distribute it. So that was just way too easy because everything was in the trust, right? So all he has to do is just distribute it to the beneficiaries and call it a day. He was absolutely shocked. I mean, he obviously has to file a tax return for the final year and everything, but as far as distributing assets, he didn't have to go through the courts because they had done everything correctly. And he's like, okay, so my wife and I will be in next week to meet with you because we want one of these. We want everything to be as seamless as this was. Dave and I could talk forever, but we would love for you guys to give us a call. The phone number here is 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900.
Since you're given the phone number, Debbie, I might as well mention how people could register for the webinars as well. We talked about the schedule. You can go to our website, herzoglaw.com, seminar page, and click on whichever webinar you'd like to attend. You can also email us at info@herzoglaw.com or call the office as well as for a consultation, 518-465-7581. One of the things I wanted to talk about this week was a conversation that Mike and I had. Mike is one of our Medicaid paralegals, and we had a consultation with a client, and it kind of went like this, and I've dealt with it personally. My mom has dealt with it personally, and I wonder how many people out there are as well. So, Debbie, here's the deal. Client called, our client's son, and said, I think we need to do something because pretty soon, in the next year, we're going to run out of money. And I said, well, that's not good. What are we spending our money on that we're going to run out of money? And this is, you know, Dad's money that he's talking about. Dad's living at home. They're paying for caregivers to take care of Dad so he could stay at home. They're exhausting Dad's Social Security and pension, a little bit of a distribution that's, you know, an RMD, required minimum distribution from retirement. And now they're actually going into the retirement as well, wholesale, to generate money to pay. And he said, you know, at the end of the day, whether it's 8 or 9 months from now, we're going to have to make a decision and probably put Dad in a nursing home because of the Medicaid program. And we said, well, that certainly would be the case if you didn't talk to us and we didn't have this conversation. And I think you know where I'm going, Debbie. We said, well, this community Medicaid program may really help you because it's a way to keep Dad at home, possibly keep the same caregivers, and instead of them giving $20 cash per caregiver, like they've been doing, per hour, that is, we could have Medicaid subsidize the cost of those caregivers. Maybe the caregivers don't want a pay cut. I get it. So we could arrange for separate agreements where they receive some money from Dad to get them to the level of what they were receiving, you know, previously. But it's going to save $13-14 an hour to Dad, which means he's not going to need to be in this situation where people have to go to a nursing home for financial reasons, not for care reasons. I mean, there's certainly long-term care, but they could ride it out at home if they just had enough money. And that's, to me, the most heartbreaking fact pattern. Someone who can stay at home, aids are available, Debbie, but they just are going to run out of money because it's expensive. And that's where this community Medicaid program makes so much sense.
It does. And there's not a lot of people that know all the ins and outs of community Medicaid and or chronic care Medicaid. And that's why we really have a great staff. We have 3 Medicaid paralegals that all used to work for the Department of Social Services. We always laugh and say that they used to work for the dark side, you know, and they know the ins and outs. And we also have Kim Hance, who is our geriatric care manager, who knows a lot of the ins and outs as far as things that are available for people that just need respite. A lot of times we can get people some hours if the person has Alzheimer's through Eddie, right? They can get a few hours from the Eddie just for a little bit of respite. But at the end of the day, you really need to figure out something long term.
Exactly right. And so a little side back pattern. So this is a personal one, Debbie. Family member of mine, elderly family member, she's in assisted living. My mother is in charge of the finances. The assisted living is expensive. And so the way that my mom is coming up with money for this relative's assisted living is regular income plus taking, again, amounts from retirement. And she's talked to me and said, at what point do we apply for Medicaid? And that fact pattern, right, I could almost mark it on the calendar. We will eventually run out of money, and this family member who does have long-term care needs but who is doing just fine in assisted living will end up in a nursing home one day because there literally will be no money. Now, if that relative was at home or in a facility that took Medicaid, we would be able to at least lengthen the amount of time. But the goal in that fact pattern, it's not to leave money to kids or relatives. It's to maximize the amount of time that this loved one can stay out of the nursing home because money is not the most important thing. The most important thing is the care. And so sometimes we don't have a choice, and that's how, you know, the world's going to work. One day we will need a nursing home because we can't afford anything else. But if you're at home, in your home, in an apartment, in a room in your kid's home, this community Medicaid program, it's incredible because it can make it more affordable to stay at home and thus lengthen the amount of time we're not in the nursing home. And to that end, Debbie, we always talk within the office. We have Medicaid meetings where all of our staff that handles Medicaid applications, we put our brains together and see what's going on with different fact patterns. It's looking more and more like, Debbie, the look-back period that was supposed to be instituted on October 1st of this past year. The rules for it may not actually go into play for some time, for a number of months, maybe into April and beyond, which means, everyone, if you're sitting there and you're thinking, man, this thing sounds good, but there's a look-back period, or I heard there's a look-back period, we may be able to get away with Medicaid applications for home care with no look-back period. That means we'll talk to you on Monday to talk about moving assets around into a trust and getting mom or dad or aunt or uncle qualified for this program to lengthen the quality of life at home. This is big.
Oh, it's huge, because we had a big rush of people that were applying for community Medicaid right before the change in October. And the reason they did that, because even if you only need a few hours now, right, even if you only need, like, we always use Harry's mother-in-law as an example, right? Whenever she first went on community Medicaid, she was only getting like 6 hours a week. And by the time she passed away, she was getting 10 hours a day, 7 days a week. So if you need some care, you know, if you need somebody that's just in a few hours a week just to kind of get in the program and get things going, you should do it now, right? You shouldn't wait. She, like I said, she was only getting 6 hours a day or 6 hours a week. And to the point where they reevaluated because her situation progressed. And again, she had 10 hours a day, 7 days a week by the time that she passed away, and she got to stay home.
Not everyone, has Harry Miller, a 40-year estate and elder law attorney as their son-in-law, lucky enough to be on top of it like his mother-in-law had. That's what these programs are for, and the webinars and the word of mouth and all that stuff. The general mantra and the rule that we have around here, especially when the rules are changing in the government and the Medicaid regulations are in flux, it's always the same thing. It's the earlier you plan, the better. If there's a 5-year look-back period, well, you know what? Tomorrow it's a 4-year and 364-day look-back period because you set up a trust today. And the earlier you act, always the better. And, yeah, of course, you mean the attorneys that whose business is estate planning tells you got to do estate planning? Wow, what a shock. Well, yes, that's, me being sarcastic about it. But it's the truth, because people who missed the boat on October 1st, Debbie, but nonetheless created a trust or applied for Medicaid in November, December, January, tomorrow, they may end up not having a look-back period, and the things that they did, even after they potentially missed the old, October 1st marker, well, they're going to benefit from delays in this program and the changes to the program. And guys, it's COVID era, right? You should expect delays. So get cracking and get these applications in while Medicaid is not looking for 2.5 years of paperwork, when Medicaid is not looking to see how you got qualified, right? Historically, there's been zero look back period. And we would say it all the time on the radio, Debbie. You'd say today is, January 15th. On February 1st, you can qualify, right? That's what we've always said. And you know what? On February 1st, it sounds like you can qualify now because of this delay in the implementation of the rule. So get on it.
Get on it. That's the call to action. Get on it, right? So we would love to you to get on your phone and give us a call at 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900. Dave and I were laughing this week. We had a meeting, and I had done a presentation this week on one of the webinars, what to do when a loved one dies. And one of the things I talk about on the webinar is that if a person is a felon, and there's certain rules on that, that they can't be an executor. And someone had sent an email to Dave, and they had said, well, you know, what if they're out of jail and they're on parole and blah, 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 blah. And Dave's like, well, what exactly did they do? And what did they respond, Dave?
Well, they just, apparently, so let me just set this back a second, Debbie. So the idea is that when people are going to be named executors or trustees, right, they're fiduciaries and they're potentially in charge of a lot of money. So in general, the rules are that if you've been convicted of a crime that deals with, violations of trust, so embezzlement and things like that, right, you're not going to be eligible or likely won't be eligible to be an executor or trustee. And obviously, people can be rehabilitated and something that happened early on in life, you know, it's different. And the gentleman that messaged me said, well, if they're through parole, what then? And I said, well, possibly sounds better, certainly, than them actually being incarcerated at the time, which would be a non-starter. Out of curiosity, what's the crime? Because I'm thinking, Debbie, well, if they robbed a bank, right, they can't become a trustee of a bunch of money. And his response was murder. And I was kind of taken aback because, yeah, that's not going to work. I don't think our executor is going to be able to be someone convicted of the highest crime I could think of, next to sedition or whatever is going on in other parts of our world these days.
Yeah, I mean, anyway. It's interesting. You know, you don't think about those things. I had a client that actually the co-executor was in jail when mom passed away, and he wanted to be co-executor. And he couldn't be because of it's all about what you're accused of or what you're in jail for. But that's kind of a depressing thing to think about. So let's think about something more exciting, about someone giving us a call and asking questions at 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900. You know, when Jay and Marie and I are on here together, it seems like we get a lot more calls.
I think, personally, it's because they don't want to hear either of you speak, and they just want to call. That's my two cents. I'm kidding. That's mean.
Speaking of calls, looks like we have one. Are you ready? We got Leo from Greenbush on the line for you.
Morning, Leo.
Good morning. Is that something you wanted to call? And here's a call. All you have to do is ask. I have some questions. If I could, what I'd like to do is ask the questions and then hang up and hear your responses on the radio. Is that going to be okay, or shall I stay?
That's fine. Go ahead.
Here's the first question. So if a person is already in a nursing facility, what are the things to watch out for to move from one nursing facility to another? That's one. Long-term care, I should say. Long-term care place to another long-term care. The second is when a person is already in Alzheimer's unit, then what should they be careful about to move a person to a nursing home? And then you probably don't have enough questions, so I'll ask another one. The third question is, would you comment, please, of the difference between a revocable trust and an irrevocable trust? And here's my last question. It's, if I could, just one more. It's very easy, I think. It's not that nothing's easy to me or to anyone unless you know the answer. So some time ago, I had a trust, irrevocable, and used up all the assets. So the question is, should I attempt to reactivate the exhausted irrevocable trust, or would it be better to consider a brand new trust and I'll probably come to Herzog to talk about it. Well, there's some questions. Okay, to hang up?
Yeah, sure.
Go ahead.
Call.
Okay, I'm going to turn the radio back on.
Radio go for it, Dave.
So I was just looking at the clock, Debbie. So we have a couple minutes before the break, and I'd like to save, Leo, the revocable, irrevocable discussion for the second half hour. So let's tackle those first two questions. And Kim and I have had a lot of discussions about this. So what are the things to consider between long-term care facilities, and at what point or what should we consider if someone's in memory care in assisted living and wants to move or is thinking about moving to a nursing home? So a couple cautionary things, because there's so many moving parts, right? The things to consider are where is the facility located? What kind of family members are going to be able to visit? You know, what are the rankings of this facility and the cleanliness of it? If it's regular long-term care, do they have a memory care facility there? A lot of times we're advocating for places that are essentially like campuses, where there might be an independent senior living building, which is, you know, 150 feet away from the assisted living building, which within it has a memory care unit. And then one building over, it's the nursing home. And the reason why that, I think, it becomes more attractive, although any single place might be fantastic, is because the more continuity, Leo, right, the more things that stay the same, the better the plan will be. And what I mean is, if someone's dealing with dementia, you know what? You want to really screw them up. You want them to go downhill a little faster. Move them 3-4 times within a couple-year period. New places, new walls, new faces, new rooms, new residents, right? It's enough that they're dealing with something that impairs their short-term memory, right? Or it's sometimes long-term memory. If all of a sudden we're adding to it, constantly changing the environment, and that's why the care at home ends up being so attractive, because home is always home. And there's some amount that those people dealing with cognitive issues can still, you know, be comfortable with their surroundings. So the things that I always jump to in terms of what are the considerations is, what's the plan? This place might be great tomorrow. Is this going to be the long-term care plan? I'm not talking about a couple months. I'm talking about a year, right? Is this person going to be able to age in that facility? And as their needs increase, will the facility be able to take care of it? What can't they do? And so hopefully that answers, or it helps answer a question as to what to consider. Obviously, you know, devil's in the details, guys, right? So the prognosis, what is ailing people, is it just physical, is it cognitive, and all those different pieces. Certainly, if someone's diagnosed with dementia, I'm going to want them to go somewhere that could also deal with the specific issues that someone with dementia may be dealing with, as opposed to someone who just has, you know, some really terrible transporting issues. They can't get across the room, right? They both have long-term care needs, but they're significantly different in the type of need. And we want to make sure that the facility, assisted living or otherwise, is going to be able to handle those specific issues.
That was a great answer, Dave.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I do think we might be up against the break. I don't know if we are. If you can chime in and let me know if we are.
Yes, it's about time that we take a small break here, and then we can come back and answer the rest of Leo's questions.
Sounds great.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for, options available for Medicaid planning, and more. With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany, West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs, Executive Woods in Clifton Park, and Flatbush Road in Kingston. Our attorneys are here to help you. If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David, Jane Marie Harry, or Debbie, please call us during normal business hours, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581. Our Saratoga Springs office at 518-581-8131. Our Clifton Park office at 518-952-4010. And our Kingston office at 845-338-6405. Let the Herzog Law Firm help you navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
And we're back. This is Debbie Verney.
Good morning. This is Dave Kubikian. And I hear the music for the end of the show, Debbie. That was a quick second half hour.
That was a really quick second half hour. So I think that kind of got queued up incorrectly, but we do have another half hour, and we're going to be answering your questions on estate planning, estate administration, Medicaid planning. The phone number is 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900. And we had some great questions right before we went to the break, and the last question, which we said we were going to carry over into the next half hour, was what is the difference between a revocable and an irrevocable trust?
How do you want to tackle this, Debbie? We could everyone get comfortable out there. We could go on for hours if you'd like. Well, so I like getting to the super, super basics, and I'm not being sarcastic here. But what does revocable mean? What does irrevocable mean? And when we do these seminars, less so in the webinars, it's a little less interactive, but at seminars, Debbie, if you ask, what does the word irrevocable mean? The three things you're going to hear is what? You can't control it. I can't change it. And you can't undo it, right?
Right.
And that's actually, believe it or not, wrong when it comes to the Medicaid Asset Protection Trust, which is a form of irrevocable trust. So in terms of trust, guys, right, it's not just there's one size fits all. There's different kinds of irrevocable trust. There's different kinds of law, right? Of course, there's different kinds of trust. There's different kinds of irrevocable trust. But what does that word irrevocable mean? It means literally, and this is where people throw things at the seminars. They throw like tomatoes at me, Debbie. Irrevocable means, get ready, not revocable. Okay? have minds exploded? Right? Irrevocable means not revocable. It means not something. So now we got to say, well, what does revocable mean? If irrevocable means not revocable, what does revocable mean? Well, revocable means as follows. It means specifically the person who created something can by themselves undo that something. That's what revocable means. Now, we use these words in, you know, normal conversation, and if I said that you're irrevocably giving me $5, right, everyone would say, well, you just gave me $5 and now it's mine. But in the legal world, these words have specific meanings, and we're stuck with those specific meanings and not the connotations that come with these words. So revocable means you by yourself can undo it. So Debbie, when you create a revocable trust, that, you know, obviously you are the creator of it, that means regardless of who the trustee is, regardless of who the beneficiaries are, you, whenever you feel like it, Debbie Verney, you can take all the money out of that trust tomorrow. You can blow it up tomorrow. Why? Because it's a revocable trust, and because of that, it means you, the creator, by yourself, could do whatever you want. Okay.
Sounds
so
great.
So far, so good. So revocable trusts are great for a lot of things. Do you mind getting into, Debbie, reasons why people may do just a revocable trust?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of reasons. The majority of the reasons that I have people do revocable trust is because they have, well, there's a couple of good reasons, but one of them, the major one, is that they have assets in different states, right? Yeah. So I have my summer home in New York and I have my winter home in Florida. So when I pass away, they're going to have to probate my will in New York and then they're going to have to probate it in Florida. So if I had a revocable trust and I deed both properties to the trust, then whenever I pass away, whoever the backup trustee is steps up, deeds out the New York property, deeds out the Florida property, no probate, no court, no muss, no fuss, and doesn't become public record. One of the things that I use for an example as far as people that probably could have used a revocable trust, all of you know Mary Lou Whitney, right? And you probably saw in the paper, she died about a little over a year ago, how her will was probated in Saratoga County and who got what. And, you know, there's this big article about some of the kids got more than others. Well, if she'd had a revocable trust, none of that would have become public, right? They wouldn't have had to file the will. And they also mentioned in the article that she had property in Florida and she had property in Kentucky. So not only are they going to have to probate her will in New York, now they're going to have to probate it in Kentucky and they're going to have to probate it in Florida. So, again, if she'd done a revocable trust, she would have been still in control of it until she passed away. She passed away, the trustee steps up, could have distributed the assets, and no one would have known who got what or what she had. But now it's public record, right? It's filed at the Saratoga County Surrogates Court. People could find out exactly what went on. Another reason people will do revocable trusts is if they have a situation where they have, like, 30 or 40 different beneficiaries that they want to leave assets to. I've never really had 30. I've had 20 some odd. But if you have a situation where you're a single person, you're not married, you don't have any kids, and you have nieces, nephews, and everybody else that you want to leave money to, you can put all those accounts in the revocable trust. When you pass away, the trust terminates, and then the trustee writes checks to everybody. It just makes everything so much easier, getting everything all in one spot. What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, absolutely. I co-sign on everything you said. Avoiding probate and then maybe messy family situations where it's not as simple as a will. It says, everything to my spouse and then everything to my kids, because maybe that's a second spouse and everyone has kids from a prior relationship and so on. But the probate avoidance, that's it. And you by yourself, because it's revocable, can undo everything with just your signature. That's what revocable means. Now, what doesn't the revocable trust do? Well, it doesn't help with Medicaid. It doesn't help with long-term care. So let's talk about why, okay? I want you to not just know what these trusts are. I want you to know why one works for this and it doesn't work for that. Debbie, when you apply, when someone comes in and they need a Medicaid application for a nursing home or care at home, okay, and you're going to work with Jess or Mike or Karen to represent that client, we're preparing to give to Medicaid a list of all the things that that client has as a resource. What Medicaid's looking for are, what are the things that mom can touch with just her signature, that she has access to, her bank accounts, her CDs, savings bonds, brokerage accounts, cash value and life insurance, even real estate, because theoretically those assets with just the stroke of a pen from mom can turn into money. That money can be used for her care. That's what Medicaid's looking for. If we have a revocable trust as the big piece of the puzzle here, you by yourself, mom by herself, can still get to everything with just her signature. So revocable does not help when it comes to long-term care planning. Is it part of the puzzle in general? Yes. My parents have long-term care insurance, Debbie. They have a revocable trust. Why? Long-term care insurance helps with long-term care. Revocable trust helps them avoid probate, right? Just as you said. So what do we do if we're someone who's worried about long-term care? We want to preserve our assets. The issue isn't who gets what percentage of my estate. The question is, how big is the pie going to be when I die? Right? How much money was used paying for a nursing home that I could have avoided? That's where the Medicaid trust comes in. And I always say it's barely irrevocable, which actually is not a thing, but it's barely irrevocable, in that it's a trust that's dedicated to solving one problem above and beyond the revocable trust fact pattern that you were talking about. One problem is, how do we protect assets for long-term care? And the answer, and I'm going to shut up eventually here, I promise. The answer is, if Medicaid cares about the things that mom can touch by herself, we create something where mom can't touch it by herself, but she controls who can touch it with her. Meaning that if I need Debbie Burney to sign off when I'm going to pull money out of my own trust, that's technically an irrevocable trust because I, by myself, Debbie, can't do it. But you know what? I don't like the sound of that. We worked together for a really long time. I don't doubt you're going to do good by me, Debbie. But I like it a lot more when I can fire you and replace you with whoever agrees with what I'm saying all the time. And that's how the Medicaid trust works, because while technically my signature alone doesn't do a couple things, I always control whose signature I need in addition to mine. So we still control things. We still could change who our beneficiaries are and who our trustees are, but it's a trust that will make it so that the assets that were in there long enough are protected from Medicaid. And the last thing I'll say, Debbie, and then I'm going to drink something, is the word Medicaid is not in the Medicaid Asset Protection Trust. I think that's the coolest thing, and it helps explain it's the rules in the trust that dictate whether it's protecting assets, not what we call it, right? It's the rules. So hopefully, Leo, that helps with your call, and thanks so much for that question.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great question, and hopefully it'll lead into some more questions that people can give us a call. And until then, by the way, the phone number here is 518-476-5900, 518-476-5900. When you were talking about the irrevocable trust, I had a client that they moved their parent to Michigan, and she went to see an attorney there, and her dad right now is in memory care. He's not in a nursing home yet, and so they're private pay, and she was talking to him about the fact that he had a trust in New York, and I was explaining to her the difference between, you know, revocable and irrevocable trust and how the assets were protected and how even though dad's in Michigan now, that the trust would be treated as a New York irrevocable trust. And she's like, well, you know, what's that? Why do I care, right? And why you care is in New York, you can revoke an irrevocable trust, meaning you can chip off money, as I always say, kind of open the bottom of the piggy bank, shake some money out, and put the cork back in, and it doesn't break the trust if you do it correctly. Whereas a lot of other states, you're not allowed to change anything, right? Believe it or not, New York is one of the states that actually has a little bit more flexibility,
Debbie,
with the irrevocable trust.
Yeah. Don't mean to interrupt, but we got several callers on the line waiting to talk to you. First up, we've got Tina in Albany.
Morning, Tina.
Hi. I'm just going to ask a question of revocable trust.
Okay.
Can you still qualify for Medicaid with a revocable trust?
No, not with a revocable trust, because with a revocable trust, think of it this way. With a revocable trust, if you can write yourself a check, you can write the nursing home a check. So the trust would have to be irrevocable before the person would be qualified for Medicaid.
And I have another question. If someone dies without a will and they never change the beneficiary, was the ex-wife still on the beneficiary? Would the ex-wife, the new wife, and the children all qualify to be beneficiaries in that will?
So, Tina, don't go anywhere for a second. Quick question. So, we're saying someone had an old will. They named an ex-spouse as the beneficiary on that will, right?
Yeah.
And so they pass away, and they have assets. Those assets don't have beneficiaries themselves, so they're governed by the will. Is that what we're saying?
Well, there was no will at all.
If that person had... Yeah, go ahead, Tina.
Excuse me?
Tina, so I'm sorry. I was saying, why don't you go ahead? You were saying something. I interrupted you.
Oh, no. I'm just saying, like, in the insurance policy, the ex-wife or whatever, like, all their pension information was the ex-wife. They never changed it. But so all four, like there's two children and an ex-wife and a regular new wife, would all four after probate be eligible for, you know, the benefits of the estate from that person dying?
So, no, not all four. It's a little tricky how it works post-divorce. So, number one, it's important for everyone to realize that the things governed by your will are not everything someone owns. So you mentioned life insurance. Life insurance has beneficiaries, right? So typically life insurance is going to go to the beneficiary. It's not, if I had a will that said I leave everything to you and I died right now, you're not getting my life insurance. My wife would be really upset about that. She's the beneficiary on the policy. She's going to get it, okay?
Right.
Now, when people get divorced, part of the divorce process typically will involve them waiving in estate rights that they have in each other's estate. And also, sometimes they're waiving in rights they have in someone's retirement account. Okay? That's very, very typical. So as a result, the answer to your question gets into the details as to what was waived, what wasn't waived. One of the things we say all the time, Tina, is that after a big life event, and a divorce is a big life event, you have to reevaluate your beneficiaries across the board. Because while in the divorce, maybe rights were waived in the estate, remember, the estate's just the will. If there's some life insurance out there, if there's some account out there that listed an ex-spouse as a beneficiary, they may end up getting it if they didn't specifically waive rights in that specific account. So we got to be real careful, and unfortunately, it's not something where we could just give you a yes or no over the radio as a final answer.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
All right, guys, we have another call on the line for you. Right now, we've got Scott in Nassau.
Morning, Scott.
Good morning, Debbie and Dave. Hi. I have a life insurance question. I just heard you speak about, you already answered some of my questions. So if there's only, can I put more than one beneficiary on a life insurance policy?
Yeah, you can. Usually the beneficiary designation, you can get the form from your insurance company. So you can put, say, for instance, say you have three kids, you can each give them 33% or whatever. And then you also want to name contingent beneficiaries so that if something happened to your beneficiaries, that there's someone that steps up and takes. But, yeah, you can name more than one person on life insurance. Usually there's a spot for two or three people. Sometimes they'll let you continue it on the next page, but you have to be very specific as to what percentage people are going to get whenever you do that.
I have to look at that then, because I think I only have one right now. So say that one had died. What happens to that life insurance then? Who somebody has to apply for it, or what?
It would end up back payable to your estate. They'd probably have to probate your will to get an executor appointed so that they could collect the assets. Because if you have anything that doesn't have a beneficiary whenever you pass away, it ends up back in your estate.
What if you didn't have a will?
Then they're going to follow the laws of New York. So they're going to look to see, do you have a spouse? If no spouse, do you have kids? Do you have no spouse, no kids? Are your parents still alive? And it kind of goes from there. So depending on what your family situation is, kind of like I always say, they drop a brick and whoever's head it lands on, that's who gets your money.
Okay, one more question. I was a volunteer administrator once on a small state
administration.
Yeah, and it worked fine. What's the limit on that as far as money or whatever, or assets? Do you know now in New York?
Well, the small estate administration, what's that?
I mean, as far as who has what type of money they have, I thought it was like $10,000.
So a small estate is $30,000 or less.
Oh, $30,000.
You can get away with a more truncated version of an estate administration if there's $30,000 or less in the estate. And then sometimes, depending on the makeup of that money, we might be able to get away with some other forms. So when I say get away, it's not sneaky. It's just there are other ways to move assets, things like cars, if the fact pattern is just right.
Okay. All right. You answered my questions. Very, very good. Thank you.
Great questions. Thank you very much for calling.
Next on the line, we have Steve in Red Hook.
Morning, Steve.
Yes, hi. I'm just trying to get reassured that I'm going in the right direction. We have a family trust, and everything else that we have, we either have a co-ownership or beneficiary. We don't have to go through probate. Is that right or wrong?
That's correct. Sorry to always talk like this, but in case something really bad happened to you, like medical malpractice or something like that, if everything has a beneficiary or is in the trust, you'll have no reason to go through probate. That's correct.
Okay.
But the things that you have joint, okay, just because something is avoiding probate isn't going to mean it's going to be protected in case there's long-term care needs. Right. As Debbie said, they're looking for what's available to you. if you could cut a check from that joint account, to paraphrase what Debbie said, right, that's going to be an account that can be held against you in a Medicaid application. So it sounds like you have a great plan to avoid probate, and then depending on the amount of money that's outside the trust in those joint accounts or with beneficiaries, you may want to fund it a little more. That's obviously, you know, based on all the other details going on.
Mm-hmm. One other question, too. Isn't there a certain amount that you're covered for? In other words, I thought it was like if anything under $30,000, you can avoid probate.
That's right. So the caller right before you kind of asked about that as well. So there's, you're not avoiding probate. It's just the process, you know, the filing fee for a small estate is $1 as opposed to the high end of a filing fee for a large estate, which is $1,250. Mm-hmm. The process is a little easier. You know, a lot of, and it kind of has to be because sometimes people need to technically administer an estate for $4,000 that's in a bank account or something. And we don't want them spending thousands to get thousands. That wouldn't make a lot of sense.
Could I ask another question?
I got to ask Debbie. Debbie, is it all right if you ask one more question? What do you think?
Oh, sure. That's fine.
Okay, just this one time. Go ahead.
Okay. I have quite a bit of stock, and I understand on our demise that stock is valued at the time of our death.
Right.
A step
there's
up,
a,
right?
There's a step up in basis. So whatever your stock is worth at your date of death is what it's worth to your beneficiaries.
Now, the question is, supposing I paid $500 for a share, and on my demise, it's down to $200. Can we elect to take the higher?
No. Mm-mm. No. Yeah. It's a snapshot. I mean, it sounds like a bad picture, but it's a snapshot. The minute that you take your last breath is a snapshot of what those assets are worth, and that's what they're valued at to your beneficiaries. So they don't really care what you paid for it. It's what it's worth whenever you pass away.
Wow, that don't seem right.
The one thing you could do is actually do an alternate valuation date. So if it looks like all the other, you know, 6 months later, everything looks a little different. You know, if someone died right in the middle of the pandemic and 6 months later the stock's rebounded enough, you could, mm-hmm. across the board, decide to do a different valuation date, but that's for every asset. So you can't pick and choose
really
you're going to value this asset or that asset. So, but it really only matters in those, you know, really exaggerated circumstances where there's big, big shifts in valuation.
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happened someone died on the wrong day, but then things rebounded immediately.
There's goes a little through a law firm,
but you're kind of stuck.
Does that go through? That process goes through a law firm?
No. So only if there were estate taxes. The determination of the tax basis, as Debbie said, is fixed. Right? It's based on when someone passed away, and that only will mean something when the end of the day beneficiary sells that asset.
Mm.
Right? They will be selling it, and the gain that they pay taxes on will be calculated based off of that date of death tax basis. So that
all right.
Involve us.
All right. Thanks very much for explaining. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Have a great weekend.
All right, guys. So Rosemary and Latham called in. She didn't want to go on the air, but she was curious whether or not a beneficiary on a revocable trust needed to be on the house insurance policy.
Oh, that's a great question. What you need to understand is whenever you have something in a trust, right? So you have a house that's in a trust, especially a revocable trust. If you're a beneficiary, the legal term, or a beneficiary of anything, you're vested subject to divestment. That's one thing I actually learned in law school, which means today you're a beneficiary and tomorrow you may not be. So if you're the beneficiary, they're definitely not going to put you on the insurance. Whenever we do an irrevocable trust and we transfer a house to an irrevocable trust, we actually name the trust itself as an additional insured on an insurance policy, just so that if 5 years down the road the house burns down and they write the check to you instead of the trust, kind of screws everything up. So, no, beneficiaries definitely don't go on insurance policies.
All right. Thank you for that. We also have one more call, if we could get to it. Barb in Albany is on the line.
Barb?
Barb.
Good morning, everyone. I have a question about money coming into an estate as a result of a medical negligent lawsuit after the estate was settled. The estate... there was nothing that had to go through probate, so everything was, you know, went its proper ways with life insurance and bank accounts. But if something comes in from a lawsuit after all that's been done, what has to be done and how does it happen?
That's a great question, and we only have time for a pretty quick answer, and I'm going to ask you to call our office during the week to get more into it. But essentially, the estate needs to be reopened, and depending on the type of letters that were issued by the court, there may be a different process to do that. Sometimes people are executors forever until the estate's closed. The file number stays the same. They just basically reopen the estate. The idea is we need someone who's able to sign the settlement, someone who's able to receive the money from the settlement, and then distribute it based on the terms of the estate plan. And that's why the estate's going to have to be reopened. So that way the court is reauthorizing the executor to do whatever they got to do. What happens if in the interim the executor passed away or is incapacitated and is unable to act? So the courts are going to want to make sure, just as they did at the outset, that someone's able to represent the estate and then distribute based on the terms of the estate.
Well, because the estate, the original estate, didn't have to go through probate, an executor wasn't appointed, or...
So then there will be a probate now. We're out of time. Thank you so much for your call, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Okay, thank you.
You guys have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next weekend.
Take care, Debbie.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.